From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. The Army Corps of Engineers has released its report on preventing the spread of Asian carp. We'll hear a reaction from the Alliance for the Great Lakes. Then record dollars are being spent on state judicial races. What's the upshot for justice?
When you get the perception, when people have a perception that justice can be bought and sold, it undermines the whole system of our courts, our whole system of impartial justice.
We'll learn the surprising truth about the author of an iconic vegetarian cookbook. And artist Dirk Schraber destroys cars for the sake of art and discovers a transformation.
For me, it's all so abstract and just material, and I think in different ways about, of course, I know it's a car, but then at some point, it is not really a car anymore.
Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Last Monday, after the Army Corps of Engineers released its much-anticipated report of how to keep Asian carp out of the Great Lakes, the Corps began hitting the road. They're holding a series of public meetings to present their ideas, and tonight one convenes here in Milwaukee. Eventually, the report will land in the hands of Congress, which must then make the multi-billion dollar decision of which strategy to employ. The organization Joel Brammeier heads has a strong opinion on the choice Congress should make. The Alliance for the Great Lakes wants Lake Michigan to be completely and permanently separated from the Chicago River. That measure would sever the more than century-old man-made connection between the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River Basin. Brammeier told WUWM's Susan Bentz that he shared his views at the Corps' first public meeting last week in Chicago. Brammeier describes the session as energy-charged.
It was a good crowd considering that the Corps had released the information on Monday and had scheduled the hearing with just 4 days notice, 4 business days of notice. It was a good sized crowd. It might have been 75 people there. You know, it was a cordial hearing, but one that I think is expectant of action now. And that was the message I heard over and over, was that we're hearing from members of Congress and from others in the region that we're not quite sure what to make of this report, but we need to move on to building something, not more studies. And that message came through to the Corps loud and clear. A lot of people talked about the idea of physical separation of the Great Lakes and Mississippi River, which is something that we've been backing for a long time. And I think still, you know, is the only real option that's going to prevent invasive species movement. The Corps' own findings in the study back that up. They give star ratings to the various ideas that they've put forward. And the only one with a 4-star rating for stopping invasive species is physical separation.
The Corps lays out 8 plans, possibilities that could be drawn from. Was the anticipation of organizations such as yours that they would come up with 2 maximum or a single plan that they felt that would be most effective in getting the job done?
We were disabused of any idea that they were going to recommend a plan quite some time ago. The Corps all along has been saying that they don't have enough time and money to do the study the way that they want to and to recommend something. And so we were forewarned that that wasn't going to be part of this report. Nevertheless, we still need a plan to build something, not 8 options and no consensus around them. And I think that's going to be the challenge for our region, to build that consensus now and get moving on a project and not just working on more studies. You know, of the options the Corps put forward, all of them cost between $8 and $18 billion. You know, that's a lot of money. It's hard to even think about the difference between $8 and $18 billion when you're talking in those kinds of numbers. It's going to cost money to solve this problem. I think the Corps' numbers are overblown. We've taken a kitchen sink approach to this kind of a project, when in fact what we're really trying to do here is stop invasive species, not solve every single problem in the Chicago waterway because the Asian carp happened to be there. And I think that's one of the challenges we're running into right now. The Chicago waterways and the Chicago River have problems, like lots of other major cities, with pollution, contamination from many decades ago, sewage overflows, flooding. A lot of those problems are already here, and they would be here regardless of whether we were talking about separating the Great Lakes and the Mississippi River. So we've got to take a hard look at the numbers that Corps put forward and some of the work that's been done before by others and figure out where the consensus lies on how to get to separation.
I'm looking at an article that was written up in the Chicago Tribune. I'm not talking to the source here. I'm reading what I see in print, and that a lobbyist from, it says, one of the industries still relying on the river system sees it differently, that the study clearly indicates that physical separation is too expensive, too slow, and too uncertain to be viable.
Every option that the Corps put forward that is remotely defensible in preventing invasive species from getting into the Great Lakes will cost billions of dollars. The cost is not the issue. Separation is the solution that provides the greatest potential prevention against invasive species for the Great Lakes. That's not in question. It's been confirmed by the Corps. It's been confirmed by other studies. There's nothing really to talk about there. All the Corps study does is say these options, separation or no, are going to cost billions of dollars and take a really long time. Well, we need to move beyond that and say, how can we do this cheaper and how can we do it faster? Because $18 billion in 25 years is not going to work for the Great Lakes or, for that matter, for the Mississippi River. We got to get past those headline grabbers from the first couple days of this week and dig into what it's actually going to take to stop invasive species, not load up this project so it starts to creak and break under its own weight, which I think is what could have happened. Frankly, in the last week, I've seen the momentum shift, and people from around the region are saying, we've got to move on this, and we've got to move now, because we've got the core zone studies coming out telling us the electrical barrier that's supposed to be stopping these fish isn't actually working. And that's adding renewed urgency to coming to one of these solutions.
Joel, is it the existing freight industry, is it that component, that group that is the most difficult to overcome?
In the Chicago area, you've got waterways that are used for commerce, but you've got an infrastructure that hasn't been updated for decades. And you've got cargo volumes that are declining over many decades. Just in the last year, two coal-burning power plants closed down in Chicago. Well, guess what? One of the primary reasons for barging cargo into Chicago was to ship coal. The uses that used to be there are starting to go away. And the reality is 20 years from now, waterborne commerce on the Chicago River is going to look a whole lot different than it does today, whether or not separation happens. We've got to incorporate that planning and that vision into the solution to the Asian carp problem. Otherwise, frankly, I think the shipping industry is going to get left behind. I think, in fact, that issue is out there. But in reality, it's the question of how do we move all these billions of gallons of water where they need to go to protect public health, to protect property, and make sure that we don't actually add to the existing flooding problem. That's the more challenging question. But again, as I said before, those problems are here today. They're going to be here tomorrow, whether or not the Asian carp is in the Chicago River, and they've got to be solved. We cannot build our way out of those problems on the backs of the Asian carp. I think there's an opportunity to exert a vision here that fixes a lot of problems all at once. The door's open, and we've just got to find a way to step through it.
Do you find that when you can get people out on different spots of the system, that they can better comprehend what the issues are or how this could work?
I think it's very challenging. The Chicago waterway is extraordinarily complex and highly engineered, and if you don't have the familiarity with it on how it functions, it's very difficult to understand why we can't just flip a switch and stop the water moving tomorrow. But the reality is that we can't. So yeah, getting people out to the system makes a big difference. As important as that is getting people out to the Illinois River and the Wabash River and seeing what's going on with the carp jumping out of the water and taking up all of the biomass in those rivers and thinking about what that would mean for places like downtown Chicago or downtown Milwaukee. And once you see what the carp can do to a river, it's terrifying to think about that going into our Great Lakes cities. That's why I don't think anybody in our region wants to have any part of letting those things into Lake Michigan.
There will be these public meetings, these hearings. What does the Corps say they're going to be doing with the opinions and, you know, what they're hearing from the public around those hearings?
What I heard is that the Corps is not going to change the report based on public comment, which is obviously concerning. I don't think that's going to change, but that's what they told us last night. They're going to put all the public comment into a report and feed it back to the region. What I would like to see is over the next 3 months that the Corps actually uses this time to start building the consensus it needs to build with interests in the Great Lakes region to actually put a real solution on the table that Congress can fund and the states can get engaged with and all the stakeholders in the region can support. That's really would be the best use of time right now. So public comments appear to not be able to shape this report. Hopefully that time can be used productively by building a consensus in the region that we need to move forward and start investing in a project.
Do you have concern that things will stall when this report, the study, moves on to Congress?
There's no way with the urgency around stopping these fish from getting into the Great Lakes that we are going to stall. Whether or not the Corps has recommended an option in January of 2014 doesn't determine whether or not the Great Lakes will cry out for the protection they need and get the protection they deserve. We have the momentum coming out of this study to make a decision about how to protect the Great Lakes from invasive species, and I'm confident that we can do that.
And 25 years, do you think it really needs to take that long? It would
absolutely not. There are other recommendations that have been put out there for how this could be implemented in a stepwise fashion, building the components of something that gets you in the long run to separation. Having said that, I don't think it takes 25 years to do this at all, any more than I think it's going to take until 2029 to stop Chicago's sewage overflow problem, which is what we've been told by the local sewage district. So those timelines can be compressed. That's why we need to take the information that's in the Corps report, put our heads together, cut out the fat that doesn't need to be there, and get to a solution that can actually be built in time to protect the Great Lakes.
Later today, the second of the Corps' public meetings takes place here in Milwaukee, and I know you've urged people to go out to these hearings. Does it give you pause that the Corps is not going to consider adjusting their plan, their recommendations, based on what they're hearing from the public at these hearings?
I have worked on this process long enough to know where we need to go. And where we need to go is not arguing back and forth with the Corps about what's in the report. It's taking the good information that's in there and using it to come to a recommendation that our region can support to get the separation. And that's where the priority needs to be.
So you're not saying don't go to the hearing?
I think the hearings are incredibly important because the hearings are a way for everybody who has been concerned about this issue for years to make it very clear to the federal government that our region is going to step up and figure out how to solve this problem, regardless of the fact that the Corps has not been able to make up its mind about the right solution for the Great Lakes.
Did you expect more from this report?
By the time that Congress ordered the Corps to finish the report in 18 months, I did not expect it to be much more than what they delivered. That's not to say that it shouldn't have been or that it couldn't have been, but I didn't expect much more. What I would have liked to have seen is a complete analysis of what it takes to get to the option that we know is going to protect the Great Lakes, physical separation. That's not what the Corps delivered. I know that that's what some members of Congress were looking for, and that's not what they got. But again, I'm not going to spend my time going back and forth about what should have and shouldn't have been in the report. We've got good data, good information, and good momentum. Let's grab it and move on.
Joel Brammeier is the president and CEO of the Alliance for the Great Lakes. He spoke to WUWM's Susan Benz after the Army Corps of Engineers public meeting in Chicago on Friday. There will be a public meeting this afternoon in Milwaukee at MATC. It begins at 4 o'clock. There is more information available at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. Coming up next, how is outside money impacting judicial elections in places like Wisconsin? We'll find out when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. It's Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Big money has had a hold on politics for a while, but a recent report points to its now significant influence on judicial elections. The report by the nonpartisan group Justice at Stake calculates $56.4 million were spent on state Supreme Court elections in 2011 and 2012. $33.7 million was spent on TV ads alone in places including Wisconsin, whose ads landed it in the report's Hall of Shame. Last month, a legal organization here in Milwaukee heard from a former Mississippi Supreme Court justice who experienced the influence of money firsthand. Oliver Diaz spoke at the winter meeting of the Wisconsin Association for Justice in early December. He also spoke with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke and explained why we should care about the money being spent in judicial elections and, more specifically, where it comes from.
In Mississippi and Wisconsin, very similar, actually, we elect our judges. For years in the United States, judges have been out of the political realm, actually. Even though we elected them, it was not the type elections that you see, the partisan type elections that you normally see in other races. In 1990 in Mississippi, the average winning Supreme Court justice spent $25,000 to get elected. In 2000, the year 2000, 10 years later when I first ran, that amount was up to $1 million. During the time period of the 1990s, you see how exponentially the amount of money judicial campaigns started absorbing. And it sort of changed the face of the judiciary. When you get a politicized judiciary, it sort of undermines what we were doing in this country. We want fair and honest judges. We don't want political partisans.
Why hasn't this been an issue for longer? As you say, judicial elections are nothing new. Campaign spending is nothing new. So what happened in the 1990s to lead to this?
It basically goes back to the tort reform movement. And for the folks who aren't familiar with tort reform, it's issues that were raised in the legislature. Business interests wanted to come in and change laws, sort of maybe put caps on damages. They talked about frivolous lawsuits and things like that. Well, what was happening was they began to pass these bills through the legislature doing things that they called tort reform. The problem with that is the courts oversee lawsuits. I mean, we have a right to a jury trial in the United States. And some of these laws were taking away your jury rights. I mean, why should the legislature set a cap or a limit on how much you could recover when a jury is awarding this certain amount? So what would happen was these laws were being tested in the courts and judges were finding that these laws may be unconstitutional. So the business interests that were supporting these laws realized that they needed judges on the courts that would uphold the legislation that they were actually passing through the legislature and the executive branch.
Well, and your own experience illustrates this issue, right? I mean, this was the issue that got a lot of attention paid to your campaign.
Oh, exactly. And it's not just happening in Mississippi. It's not just happening in Wisconsin. The forces that are behind this, and you see these massive amounts of money basically coming out of Washington, D.C., and it's basically these conservative business groups that are dumping lots of money, and they do it independently, actually, not even through the campaign. They're buying 30-second television ads and trying to influence the elections that way.
Do you see this issue as any different than any other form of campaign finance reform?
Well, that's the problem, is when you get into the judiciary. You know, we expect partisan elections for governor or for the executive branch, for president, or for the legislature. And the candidates take a position and they say that I'm for this and, you know, elect me because I'm a conservative or I'm a liberal or whatever it is. We expect that. But judges are not supposed to be partisans, political partisans. Everybody wants a fair and honest judge. We don't want to judge one side or the other. Judges are supposed to be governed by the rule of law, by the facts of the case, by the evidence in each case, and not by a political philosophy. When the courts are no longer fair and impartial, but rather partisan participants, then you get a whole different face for the judiciary at that point.
Well, and so is there any way to chart the practical implications of the spending? I mean, is there any way to say that because this one group put this sum of money into this race, a decision turned out a certain way? Because I would think justices would make the point that they are not for sale.
Well, you know, that would be interesting to do a study to see if campaign contributions, if you give certain money, will a case come out a certain way? Most judges will recuse themselves if they get direct money, but a lot of these interest groups do not give money to judges, so they're not reported. But it goes much deeper than that, whether or not it actually influences the decision. When you get the perception, when people have a perception that justice can be bought and sold, it undermines the whole system of our courts, our whole system of impartial justice.
Why isn't this a freedom of speech issue? Why shouldn't people or organizations be allowed to spend whatever they want to say what they want about who they want?
Well, that's certainly the law. And the United States Supreme Court has held many times that that the amount of money somebody spends is a form of free speech, and you're entitled to do that. I'm not arguing that you shouldn't do that. I just want people to be aware that judges are a bit different than partisan offices, and we have to treat it that way. Judges are governed by ethics. We're governed by the state ethics bar. We're not supposed to take a stand on issues or say, you know, I'm going to convict every criminal that comes before me. We don't want a judge like that. We want a judge who's going to weigh the facts and listen to the evidence.
Do you have any sense for whether the additional money that is being spent – I mean, you talked about back before this happened in 1990 in Mississippi, the average cost of a election for Supreme Court justice was $25,000. It is exponentially higher than that now. With the additional money and attention being paid to these elections, does it increase voter participation? Is there a positive spin that more attention to these races is a good thing?
Well, actually, I think it has the opposite effects. Many studies have shown that the more negative a campaign is, it sort of suppresses voter turnout. People are sort of disgusted by the whole thing. You know, you've seen it in races for governor, for president. Last year we saw it with Mitt Romney and President Obama. They have these terrible ads that come on and say really mean things about one or the other. The difference in judicial elections is that these ads tend to define the judges. With Mitt Romney or President Obama, you get these negative ads, but it's not the only information you have. You know these guys. President Obama's been in office for 4 years. Mitt Romney's been running for president since he was 4 years old. you get a feel. These ads, the 30-second negative ads, don't define them. But with a judicial candidate, this may be the only information that the voter gets about a judge is one of these really horrible 30-second ads, and it tends to actually define the judicial candidate. You know, judges are sort of egotistic. We like to think that people know who we are. You know, we walk into the courtroom and lawyers bow and say, Your Honor, and so on and so forth. The truth is not many people know judges. You get these crazy polls every once in a while where people will realize that, you know, more people can name the Three Stooges than three members of the Supreme Court. And when you have a low name ID and these horrible ads, you can actually define a person, and that's why it's a little bit different in these judicial elections.
What about people who would say that the election of judges in the first place is a problem?
Yeah, actually, that's been argued. The Federalist Papers, when the country was formed, when we wrote the Constitution, they debated the role, how judges should be selected. It's an age-old question. There's no easy answer to that, and I think each state's going to have to decide on its own. But the way these elections have turned recently, and the ability to dump large amounts of money and actually purchase a seat on a court, you're buying a seat on the bench. It's just really unseemly.
Well, and so then in the wake of Citizens United, what do you see as the solution or solutions to this?
Well, there are lots of different solutions. The main solution is education. And the voters have to be informed independently of these 30-second ads. You know, that's an idealistic approach. It's very difficult for voters to inform themselves and get ideas of who the candidates are, especially with judges when you're not allowed to take a position on certain issues. All you can say, you know, I've been a lawyer for 40 years. Well, I've been a lawyer for 45 years, therefore I'm better. But there you have to educate yourself. You know, there are also different options, retention elections. There are public funding of elections. There are lots of different solutions and you know, what I want to do is get the debate started, let people think about what's going on, because most people don't realize right now that that the seats on the Supreme Court or sometimes the lower courts are actually being purchased by special interest groups.
Well, and so let me ask you this. Maybe it's a strange question, but let's say you are the average voter and you're trying to distance yourself from the campaign ads that paint potential would-be judges in a certain light. What are the kinds of things that you would look for in deciding who to vote for in a Supreme Court or even a lower court race?
Well, you know, there are lots of independent voter guides. A lot of independent groups put out report cards on judges. The Bar Association is always a great resource. They know the lawyers who are running. If all else fails, ask your local attorney. I mean, we as a Bar Association, lawyers and judges have to take this into our own hands. We know the candidates who are running better than anybody else. We have to get out. I mean, lawyers should be going out to their local Rotary clubs or chambers of commerce and educating average people about who these are that are running for these jobs. But it all goes back into more information, and the more information a voter can get, the better decision they can make.
But it is a thorny issue when you consider that judicial candidates can't say that, you know, I would rule in a certain way about a certain issue.
Exactly, and that makes my point as to why judicial elections are different from legislative elections and executive branch elections. Judges can't come out and say, I'm going to do such and such on every case that comes before me. We don't want judges who do that, and that's why judicial elections have to be different than other elections.
Oliver Dias, thank you so much. Best of luck to you.
Thank you. I enjoyed being here today.
Oliver Dias served as a justice on the Mississippi State Supreme Court. He's now a lawyer in private practice, and his story of being targeted by outside money was told in both a documentary and a John Grisham novel. He spoke on the subject last month in Milwaukee at the winter meeting of the Wisconsin Association for Justice, and our interview with him first aired then. Coming up next, we'll speak with the author of a seminal cookbook in vegetarian cuisine. A chat with Molly Katzen is next when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks for joining us. There are a few cookbook titles that seem to reside in every busy home kitchen. The Joy of Cooking is an example. And since the late 1970s, the Moosewood Cookbook has graced many a kitchen counter. The book, written by Molly Katzen, is one of the New York Times' top 10 best-selling cookbooks of all time, and it's perhaps the most influential vegetarian cookbook ever. Katzen wrote the cookbook while a member of the Moosewood Collective in Ithaca, New York, but she now lives in Berkeley, California. Her latest book seeks to bring vegetarian cooking to a new generation. It's called The Heart of the Plate. Back in November, Molly Katzen talked with Lake Effect's Nathan Royster about the state of vegetarian cooking and whether she considers herself a vegetarian.
Well, it depends on how you define vegetarian, which I find problematic, because for most people, this is not the answer you expected. For most people, when you ask them if they're a vegetarian or not, the answer is to whether or not they eat any meat or fish. But it doesn't necessarily mean they eat anything good or any vegetables. So I'm somebody who eats a ton of vegetables and fruit, but I also sometimes eat some meat. So I don't really define myself at all as a vegetarian, but I am a vegetarian cook, and I am a veg-centric, I am a plant-forward omnivore, if you have to label the eating, that's what I would say.
Well, there's also, have you heard the term flexitarian?
I have. I have to tell you, I am not a fan of labeling oneself based on what one eats. Flexitarian's been pretty cool, but it's just, you know, sort of unsexy. So everyone wants to be sexy, so I would just say I love plant food. I'm plant foodophile.
Well, and you've been doing cookbooks for a very long time now. I'm wondering how you go about making a new cookbook and keeping it very fresh and unique and interesting for yourself even.
You know, I love the produce so much. My cooking is so produce-based that if I just go to a produce market or a farmer's market and I sort of walk up and down, see what's there, I can get so much inspiration just from the food itself. It's just, you know, the colors and just it's not just being struck by lightning and having inspiration. It's also, there's a certain logic to looking at ingredients and kind of figuring out how they might go well together.
The subtitle of your book is Vegetarian Recipes for a New Generation.
Uh-huh.
Now, what does this generation want or need that maybe past generations of vegetarians didn't?
What's really interesting, you know, the word vegetarian is something we just talked about, but the word generation in that secondary title is also something that sort of has layers of meaning for me. First of all, yes, I am writing this for a generation that's coming up, a generation that my children are in their 20s, and speaking kind of to the people I know in that generation, what their take on food is, what their taste is, their skill set. But it's also referring to several other meanings of generation. One is the idea of regenerative renewal in any given person, no matter what their age is. So I've had a couple of older people say to me, oh, you know, the subtitle of your book indicates that maybe it's not for me, but maybe it's only for young people or only for people who define themselves as vegetarian. But what I say to them is, no, it can be you in a new generation of your own eating. It can be a regenerative state of, you know, discovering new and fresh ways to eat. And the other definition of the word generation is it refers to my own cooking. So that generation is the kind of multi-pronged meaning. But I do experience, back to the original question, that there's just a lot of people coming up in the, you know, who are in their teens and their 20s right now who are very interested in plant food, whether or not they might also be interested in eating some meat. There's a lot of very strict non-meat eaters, too, but there's a lot who are just... I just love the possibilities of cooking with plant food.
So is there an aim to this book? Like, do you want people to think of vegetables as more acceptable without the ham hock on top of it, or is it to change people over to the side of vegetables?
Well, I want that side of vegetables. The heart of the plate, which is the title of the book, we talked about the secondary title, but the main title, that heart of the plate refers to kind of the arrangement of food, the real estate on the plate, like what's where and what's center. And the center of the plate in our culture has always been, for the most part, a big hunk of meat. And so I want to get people rearranging that plate and kind of rebalancing it with different kinds of foods, whether there's meat on it or not. So if somebody really loves to stick some ham hock in their, you know, as they're simmering their greens, I don't have any objection to that. This is not an anti-meat book. I don't care if people want to eat meat or not. If they want to, I certainly hope that everybody would eat meat judiciously and, you know, source it sustainably. But it's not really about the meat. If they want to add some meat, in fact, one of the things that I love about this new cuisine is it's very modular. And a lot of the basic plates are vegan. They would qualify as vegan because they're very just purely plant-based. But if people who love, you know, who are the kind of lacto-ovo, here comes another label, vegetarian who want eggs and cheese, that can be added on top. Or even people who love their meat can, if they want to, you know, take last night's leftover steak and slice it and put it on top of their vegetable plate. And I will not at all mind. I won't judge that. And I would hope that the other people at the table wouldn't judge it either. It's about trying to get really inclusive so that everyone's having a great time chowing down on their plant food. And some people might add animal products to it or not as accoutrement.
The other night, I decided to try out one of your recipes, and I did the Tunisian chickpea soup.
I love that one.
It's so delicious, and I couldn't believe like how simple it really was. All I had to do was I just took a short stroll, and all I needed was chickpeas for the recipe. Now, is there an overcomplication in this kind of food with that you've seen among other recipes, or are these types of people who are reading your book about vegetarian vegans, are these people more inclined to go the further mile because of their lifestyle?
You know, I think it really depends, and it depends not just on what they're willing to do, but also what people have time and space in their kitchen and the budget. When I'm creating recipes, I'm kind of in the back of my mind, I'm wondering who's making this recipe, how complicated do they want to take it? And how much space do they have to do that in their kitchen, and how much time do they have, and what's their budget. And so the chickpea soup is one of my favorite examples of one of those recipes that costs practically nothing and takes up very little space in your kitchen. It takes a bit of time to simmer, but that's on the stove, and you're busy doing other things as long as you don't forget it's there. You know, that it practically cooks itself. So there's that. But what I do in my recipes throughout this book is I'll keep... In the actual body of the recipe, I'll keep to the essential ingredients, the structure of the dish, the minimal amount of things it'll take to get this thing interesting and delicious, and so it has a finished taste to it. And then I have a second section, not that it feels complicated, but because I have such a great designer on this book. She really was able to take this other section and put it in a place that's, where it's visible but not cluttered or overwhelming. And the second section is called optional enhancements. And in that particular recipe, the chickpea one that you mentioned, there's a lot of them because it's ways the reader, the cook, can take these recipes farther towards a little more complexity or in the direction of their taste and customize them, make it their own. So with that one, there's a lot of choices of things that you can add, a poached egg or a little salad or just right on top of the soup or some olives or
Yeah, and I think there was some saffron you could add into it too.
Good, and that's lovely, but yeah. Saffron is a bit pricey, and that's not everyone's taste. I don't like to have those options be too close visually to the rest of the recipe.
Yeah, they seem to be kind of separated by the page, really. Mm-hmm. And along the lines of the format, it is a very visually striking book. Illustrations are great.
Because I did them, because it's my favorite part.
They really bring out a liveliness and kind of a biological feel among it. That's a very astringent word. But another question along those lines is that not all recipes have a picture. Well, it's kind of inane to even bring it up. I think it's important because this generation seems to be very much focused on visuals. Was that something you discussed, whether or not that should be an option or have a picture for every recipe?
I would have loved that if there had been the space. So there are all these different considerations that go into making a cookbook, and one of them is price and space. And so there's always this juggling act when this is going to get a little technical. There's always this juggling act of how much to include, not just of the photos or illustrations, but also how many recipes to include, because you can probably be pretty sure than any cookbook you look at, more recipes were developed for that book than actually appeared in the book. Some of them just had to get cut because of length and because color photos are expensive both to produce and also to print in the book, to actually shoot and then to print. Publisher has a price point where we don't want the book to become too expensive to the purchaser, to you guys out there buying the book. So we have to make decisions about length, not only of the text, but also the number of photographs and illustrations. In my perfect world, I had about 25 more recipes I wanted to include, maybe 30, and I would have loved to have taken pictures of everything, although it would have taken a lot longer. This is a lot of production detail you're getting here. So we're always juggling. We want to make the most beautiful book we can, and we want it to be a reasonable price.
And I don't think it's really... It's information that I think we kind of need to know as well, because recipes are so prevalent online.
They are. And in fact, it's the recipes online and the blogs that have really made it almost de rigueur that we have to have photos and cookbooks, which is fine. I mean, I think it makes cookbooks really beautiful and really compelling. But not that long ago, cookbooks didn't necessarily have photos at all. And a little bit longer ago, they didn't really have them. Or maybe they'd have them in inserts where you'd have all the photos grouped in one section, not with the recipe. There might be line drawings. I did a lot of line drawings in my earlier cookbooks, like Moosewood Cookbook and The Enchanted Broccoli Forest. I actually not only just have line drawings, I wrote them all out by hand, dating from my hippie days as a journal keeper and someone without a typewriter at the time, being a pre-computer. But photos in cookbooks, photos with recipes is relatively new, and they used to be in magazines, but not in books so much. But since the internet and since blogging, they're pretty much required.
I'm very interested in what you think of the trends that have gone on, and maybe trends that are happening now in meatless vegetarian meals and food. Is there something that is kind of a flavor of the year?
I'm not sure about the flavor of the year. I mean, definitely everyone's seen. A phenomenon of kale salads, and I call it a phenomenon because 5 years ago, if I mentioned kale in one of my, and I've been into kale for decades, but 5 years ago, if someone had mentioned kale, it was kind of a laugh line. Now it's like you've got to have kale salad on your menu, or people will complain. And I personally like kale salads just fine, but I'm still somebody who likes kale. But even if it is salad, I like it slightly cooked. But that's just me. So I see certain vegetables that become in you know, one at a time. Like before that, people were just going absolutely crazy over Brussels sprouts. Again, whereas once upon a time, Brussels sprouts were kind of a joke. You know, haha, you really like that stuff. But now like, people are, you know, mad about it. It's kind of fun.
Well, Molly Katzen, thank you for being on the show today.
It was so much fun. Thank you.
Molly Katzen is the author of the new cookbook, The Heart of the Plate. Her previous books include the landmark title, The Moosewood Cookbook, and The Enchanted Broccoli Forest. She spoke with Nathan Royster from her home in California, and our interview with her first aired in November. We'll take one last break, and then the contrast between catastrophe and beauty is just one element of an exhibit at the Milwaukee Art Museum. We'll learn more about it when Lake Effect returns on WUWM. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. If you've walked along the lakefront by the Milwaukee Art Museum in the past few months, you may have seen a new sculpture and done a double take. The piece features a compact car, well, a really compact car, as it's smashed up and wrapped around a pole. The installation is part of an exhibit that opened in early November at the museum. It's called Currents 36, Dirk Schreber. The exhibit features nine paintings by the German-born Schreber, each featuring an image that is both aesthetically beautiful and also catastrophic, from an overturned and burned-out camper to foreboding images of a scuba diver holding a weapon. It also features the American Museum debut of his 2012 video, Turgidity, which depicts the destruction of a car in slow motion. Schreber and exhibit curator Margaret Andera joined Lake Effect's Mitch Teich the day the exhibit opened in November to share more of the story. Andera explains what first drew her to Schreber's work.
At the museum, we had been interested in Dirk's work for a while. We had followed his paintings, and then when he started doing the sculptures, and actually a local collector suggested that we visit his studio when we were in New York. And we went there, and Dirk showed us around, and we saw some of the paintings he was working on, and we were more and more interested as we spent time there. And then we actually got a sneak preview of his first work in video. It was on his laptop, and it was taking this concept of the car crash into a new media for him, video. And it was right then and there in the studio, I think, where we sort of looked at each other, Brady Roberts, the chief curator, and I, and said, we should really do a show of this guy's work. And that was, I think, where it all started.
Well, and could I ask you this question? You know, I'm curious about both the physical installation of the car crash and the video, Turgidity, which is part of the exhibition. As a painter, you have the ultimate control over how to present things, the material. But with the actual car and the videography, are you at the mercy of how entropy works? Do you feel as an artist, are you yielding some control to the physicality of this?
For the video, the interesting thing is when it presents in such kind of slow motion. Well, in painting, there's always this moment when you go on with your painting. The same time you develop something new, you lost another painting. So the process of painting sometimes is once the painting is finished, you have lost hundreds of paintings this painting was in before. In the video, this process is not happening because, A, it's a slow motion, so you can see exactly what is happening in a very slow movement. And on the other hand, well, it loops and it goes backwards, so sometimes it feels to me there is nothing lost. And it's one of the different approaches.
Well, and what about with the physical car, the sculpture of the car wrapped around this pole? Is it similar to painting? Do you have to know when to stop, essentially?
The question doesn't come up because it's a planned destruction of a car in a facility where they used to do this in different ways. They do this every day, and you can't stop the process. So the car will be smashed around the pole, and that's what's going to happen. And then after, you could repeat it if it went wrong or so. I'm not trapped in this position that I have to say, stop here.
Do you think, and maybe this is off base, but is there something to choosing the kind of car, the process by which it's being smashed?
Yeah, basically I was thinking about the concept that I should take a new car from the band, from the belt, which was never on the road. And so I was looking at the car just as material for a sculpture. But then, well, I had a hard time to fund this concept, so I was going for the newest cars I could get. But if you do this to cars, convertible cars are looking better somehow. They come out better when they are wrapped around a pole.
Does it expose what's inside?
Yeah, better? Exactly.
Margaret Andera, what do you think people viewing this exhibit might get from the cumulative effect of seeing all of these works together rather than, say, the single sculpture or just the video installation or an individual painting?
I think the purpose of an exhibition like this, where it shows a span of work from an artist's career, I think if you would just encounter, for instance, the sculpture, you would really be stuck with that iconography, and somebody might walk away from that sculpture thinking that's what this artist does. When you then go into the museum and see that, yes, he does paintings of car crashes too, but it has a very different feeling to it, the paintings do. And then when you see the video, I think what people will come away with is thinking that this is an artist who has taken an idea or a subject matter and taken it to places that someone like me, a non-artist, would never have imagined. And then when you see the other paintings, you know, Dirk's work is, in a lot of ways, even the video and to an extent the sculpture, his work is very much about painting.
As the curator, when you see these paintings like this railroad car or the scuba diver or even something like the overturned shell of this camper, do you concoct a story in your mind?
Oh, sure. Everybody does. You can't help that. But I think one of the things that is so interesting for me in Dirk's work is the ambiguity and how you come back to the ambiguity, but you get sucked into the paintings, you get sucked into the video, and you get sucked into the sculpture. And there comes a point where the ambiguity, the subject matter doesn't even matter anymore because you're looking at shapes, you're looking at brush strokes in the painting. Beautiful moment. And it's very relaxing in you. So I think an artist who can leave it up to the viewer to make their own conclusions, of course, that's what happens with every piece of artwork. But a lot of artists aren't necessarily comfortable with that. And I think in Dirk's work, he's not only comfortable with it, but he confronts you with that, which I think sets him apart from a lot of artists.
Do you resist the urge to walk up to someone and say, well, that was completely not what I intended?
Oh, no, like Woody Allen does when he is waiting in line in front of
and
the
Marshall
cinema.
McLuhan steps in.
No, I'm happy when somebody's drifting into it and has some connection, and that makes me totally happy.
As the curator, do you lurk and listen to what people are saying?
I do. I like to hear what everybody brings to a painting. Oftentimes I am standing there thinking, oh, I never would have thought of that. Yes, perhaps that is what that is referring to. I'll have to ask him next time I see him. But it's just interesting to hear how people can – you can be standing in front of the very same object and have such differing opinions about it. Or I think this is about one thing and somebody else thinks something completely different. And as Dirk said, he's right. I mean, when they're talking about it, it means they're engaged. And that's – as a museum presenting artwork, that's all we can ask for.
I remember a scene when somebody was seeing a similar outdoor sculpture of this car, and I've heard that this person was somehow getting very emotional because there was an accident in the personal history, and I felt very kind of bad about it because it's absolutely not my intention. And then I thought, I probably should be somehow a little bit more careful because for me it's all so abstract and just material, and I think in different ways about, of course I know it's a car, but then at some point it is not really a car anymore. It's just this object where I am around for so many years, and after just painting the first painting, it's not what it is for somebody who sees that the first time, because I'm around this terms every day, day after day, year after year, so it becomes something different.
It's interesting because there are, I think, schools that go out and bring wrecked cars from, I think, typically drunk driving accidents and place them on the lawn in front of schools as a message about drunk driving. But this is clearly not as dogmatic as that.
No, not at all. It was more – it's more a fun aspect.
The video, Turgidity, that accompanies this, it is 30 minutes long and it captures really a crash that takes place in an instant. Do you imagine that the people who spend time with this exhibition will watch the full 30 minutes?
Well, I thought about that and I don't expect people to watch a full 30 minutes. I did it, but one of my favorite ideas is that some people might, in this dark room and with all this audio work and with a deep bass that and the slow motion and the option that they just drift away, and with some of these images that look like you're out in space and the size of the canvas, that they probably fall asleep or they fell into a trance-like state of mind and then wake up and they're in a different part of the video. And then so that's the way I imagine it.
It's interesting you mentioned that to you it seems like outer space, because the one excerpt from the film that I have seen reminded me in some strange way of the opening to Star Trek when the stars are flying at you, and it really does feel like you are the one moving.
Yeah, it looks like that. It can. I think it's because of the slow speed and all this shiny little elements that coming towards you or drifting away from you when it goes backwards, and I think it takes away from the destruction moment.
Do you? I mean, there are more references to your work on automotive websites than many artists probably get. Do you bristle at all as being known as the artist who crashes cars?
Yeah, I. This is something I not really appreciate, but there's no way that it doesn't go like that. But I remember back in the years when I painted the railroad cars, this was one reason I stopped doing it, because I was ending up at the railroad car painter, and that's totally ridiculous.
Dirk Schraber and Margaret Andera, thank you both so much for sharing some of the story of this exhibit with us and for sharing some of the story of your work.
Sure, thank you.
You're welcome.
An exhibit of artist Dirk Schraber's work went on display at the Milwaukee Art Museum in early November, and it runs through the beginning of March. Margaret Andera is the curator of the exhibit. It's called Currents 36, Dirk Schraber. You can see images from the exhibit at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks, as always, for tuning in today. Be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect. It's from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh air comes your way next.